All right, welcome to another edition of Ubuntu Radio. I'm back on the road again with a buddy of mine, D. You're gonna soon learn that he's from Philly and has that Philly swag. But we were hamming it up probably this week, I think. And then he mentioned just coming over to talk after sipping some brown liquor. And my mind as a podcaster going, man, podcasting, liquor, people free up, we can talk a little bit more. So popped in my head, Brown Liquor Chronicles, two brothers of a certain age sitting down, talking about whatever they want, and we're going to let the brown liquor steer us. So this is D, this is Aranda, you're at Ubuntu Radio, and what is the liquor of choice today?
So we're drinking the Balvenie, which is a single malt scotch. And for those who are unaware, whiskey is whiskey, but if it's made in Scotland, then by definition, that makes it scotch. So only whiskey from Scotland can be determined to be scotch. So this is a single malt scotch. And I actually was introduced to the Balvenie primarily because I was trying to find one of my favorite single malts, and the liquor store that I went to didn't have it. And what I was looking for was a 14-year-old Glenlivet, okay, which is another nice scotch.
Even now, I don't feel it physically, but I'm feeling already the effects, yeah. And it's only been like two sips. So what is single malt? Is there double malt, triple malt? What is that?
Well, single malt scotch is more of a straight, simpler scotch. Whereas, to contrast it, I actually started drinking scotch, 15, 20 years ago, and I started with Johnny Walker. And those people who are scotch drinkers who might be listening to this know that Johnny Walker's a blend. It's busier. So once you get used to drinking single malt, you have to really be in the mood for a blend, because a blend is going to be, it's going to have a lot of different flavors, whereas a single malt is more, it's more straightforward, right? And it's simpler. And you mentioned that you like the smoothness of it. In my mind, this is among the smoothest out there. So I got it for my boy, and he and I drank it that night, mm-hmm. And he loved it. And this dude is a scotch drinker, and he loved it. And I enjoyed it as well. So I drank both Balvenie and I drank Glenlivet. So if this series, takes off, perhaps maybe we'll get a sponsorship.
Balvenie and who else? Glenlivet, come holler at us. Find us on Ubuntu Radio, and we'll go from there.
The thing about scotch is the process of the aging. And the question becomes, okay, so what are you aging it in? So when it says Caribbean cask, what that means is the wood that makes the cask, mm-hmm. which houses the liquor for the 14 years, came out of the Caribbean.
So it's literally 14 years.
Yeah.
Exactly. Not just a name, not just a number. It's literally in a barrel for 14 years.
It's aged for 14 years. That's the reason why it costs so much. This is an $80 bottle.
And what about the other one, the Glen?
The Glenlivet?
Yeah.
That's a $90 bottle. That's a $90 bottle.
Damn. So, click, my brother.
Yeah.
We drinking some...
It's real
some,
stuff.
Some, the real stuff. So we're going to have some real conversations here on Ubuntu Radio tonight. Today, Dee and I were playing some golf, and afterwards we talked a little bit about, your life, and I found out some things that I think will make a fascinating interview about, mom and brothers and sisters and things like that, but we're not going to get into that right now. Mm-hmm. That's a little teaser for maybe some other time. But something just happened. You've been in Raleigh, North Carolina for about how long now?
6 months.
6 months. Family's going to be moving here in about...
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Can't and so wait. Your company has put you up in a very nice...
apartment.
A very nice apartment in a very nice part of town. And the reason I start with that, by saying that, is that we were in the elevator. Hmm. And again, we're two black men of a certain age. I'm 41 years old, and D's older.
48.
Much older. And so we're in the elevator, and we stop after going up probably one story, and an older white woman comes in. Mm-hmm. And it's not until we reach the apartment that we both recognize that we were both doing the same thing the minute she got in the elevator. Mm-hmm. And what was that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not lost on me that I'm a 6'2", 240-pound black man. I've been that for a long time now. And so my size, not just as a black man, but just as a person, as a man, could be intimidating, particularly to a woman, much less a white woman, much less an older white woman. And so my inclination is always to recognize my size and the fact that I may be, you know, making that person feel uncomfortable. And at the end of the day, that's not my intent. That's not what I want. So right away, right from the door, as soon as, you know, the woman walked into the elevator, I tried to do what I could to disarm whatever fear she might be feeling so that she could know and understand that, you know, I'm a good guy, and she doesn't have to be fearful. She doesn't have to be afraid. And so, I mean, I do that around white people all the time. In fact, it's almost like a reflex of sorts. You just go right into it.
Right.
And what we were talking about is, you know, there's me, Dee, and then there's my representative. And as soon as I get around white people, my representative emerges. It's almost like, you know, that movie Split.
Right.
I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, based in Philly. Based in Philly.
It's like, you know, my representative comes forward whenever they need to in order to protect all of us. We instill fear.
Right.
I mean, the cops keep saying it. I fear for my life. Even when the man's not armed. Even when the man's not even walking towards him. Even when their back is towards him. We instill fear in them. And so we have to do whatever we can to disarm that fear as best we can as a mechanism to protect ourselves. Kate's people play night or day, they're just not matching what they should do. Keep me feeling blue. Been down too long, right, wrong, I just can't stop it. Spending all day thinking just of you. Again, it's that whole idea of disarming them, telling them, I am not what you think I am. But in the space of the 30 seconds that we have on this elevator ride to wherever you're going or I'm going, I have to make sure that you don't think that. Yeah.
Now, Dee's a lawyer. Obviously been through every level of the American education system and more to get to where you are. So do you feel you've been doing that? And that's not something that's new, that whole idea of double consciousness, coined by Du Bois in the early part of the 20th century. Obviously, the slave has to put on the act. The slave has to put on the act for the master when he gets back to the house. Like, fuck that master, whatever. So we have to do that. Do you feel like you've been doing that your entire life? Been down too long, right, wrong, I just can't stop it.
You know, that's a good question, and it's not entirely clear to me when it started. You're actually challenging me to go back and think about that. But I wasn't conscious of the difference between black and white, quite frankly, when I was a teenager. And I went to a high school that was actually racially balanced, and it was a utopia of sorts. It wasn't really until Bucknell, when I went to undergrad, that I really started to understand the significance of being black. Not just black, but poor. In fact, I don't know that I knew I was poor till I got to college.
For anybody who's listening and doesn't know, Dee grew up in Philadelphia. Bucknell is a university
in Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania.
It's a liberal arts school. It's less than 4,000 kids.
4,000 people? How many brothers and sisters are there?
At the time, there were probably 90 of us out of
4,000. Damn.
Yeah. It was, I think in my class, I think there were 25 of us.
So let's do the math there. 4,000, 10% is 400. 2% of the population at the university.
Yeah, roughly 2%.
And coming from Philly, when you get there as a freshman, did you initially in your mind go, oh, this is Philly, I'm just gonna, or were you on guard? Was it so stock right away? You go to class and it's like you, and that's it. Or did you have to deal with that in high school anyway?
No, the high school that I went to was a magnet high school. So it was like 40-40-20, and I'm saying 40% white, 40% black, 20% other, the Hispanic, you know, Asian, you know, whatever. It literally was a utopia. That created in me quite, you know, just a misunderstanding of the real world. The real world is not balanced like my high school was. And just to be clear, I mean, you know, so I'm saying that it was 40-40-20. I was the student body president my senior year, so I was at the top of the mountain.
Gotcha.
You know. I was the
salutatorian. Second guy.
Yeah, exactly. I was I spoke at my graduation, which I'm very proud of. And this is a historic high school. Central High School, for those of you who know, is the second oldest public high school in the nation, behind Boston Latin. And so, you know, we have an illustrious history, and a lot of powerful people have come out of Central. So I'm very proud to be part of that lineage. And so we were always told that we are the brightest, we are the best. So it never dawned on me that wherever I chose to go, that I was going to continue to be the brightest and the best. So you get to Bucknell, where there's only, you know, 90 people who also look like me on campus, maybe two or three professors. And for the first time, you know, I'm presented with the idea that, no, you're here because of affirmative action, which is what everybody assumed. Of course, I learned that my SAT scores was just as high as everybody else's, and my grades were just as good as everybody else's, and my high school was just as good as everybody else's. So I actually wasn't there as it related to affirmative action or anything like that. It just so happened that I played football, but that's a school that doesn't give sports scholarships. So I wasn't there for football. Mm-hmm. I just happened to play football.
Gotcha.
So nevertheless, I had to fight a couple of things. One was, you know, okay, well, you're black and you don't belong here. Two, well, perhaps maybe your SAT scores weren't what everybody else's were. Three, well, you're an athlete, so you can't possibly be that smart. So all of those things were the things that I had to try to figure out how to navigate. And, you know, it took its toll. I mean, you know, it really hurt my confidence my first year. And I didn't do very well. Not because I didn't have the ability to do it, but because I didn't think I could based on what people were telling me.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stop and stare. I can't see their faces. Only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain.
So, I mean, at the end of the day, had I not had my confidence shaken, had I had some sort of support as a freshman, then maybe I wouldn't have had to go through that and doubt myself and doubt my abilities. But, you know, once I was reminded of my true intellectual power, you know, I went on and did just fine. They weren't smarter than me. You know, the fact that they had no, you know, more money didn't make any difference. At the end of the day, you know, my GPA was just as high as theirs. Right. Trust and believe, me and a couple of my friends who got into some very good law schools, we were hated. I mean, there was some true haterade going around.
Hated, and you were aware of it as you were juniors and seniors in the application process, or hated because once you applied and got in, at that point, they were like, it's got to be something wrong.
Exactly. I think in their minds, they thought, well, this is an extension of the affirmative action program or some bullshit like that. So, I mean, you know, my boy who I studied with, studied the LSATs with, he got into Duke and I got into Notre Dame. And when some of our white counterparts heard that, man, they were not happy. They were not happy. But me and my man, we did our thing, and we went to the schools that we went to, and you know, we are where we are now. My man is a vice president now down in Texas, and I'm a vice president down here in North Carolina.
So can you, as a young person, with everything that's going on, did you at that point appreciate your accomplishment? I say it because at a smaller scale, the same thing kind of happened to me. And it's funny, I didn't know this is one of the first conversations we're really having with D, because we've known each other probably what?
2 months.
Two, 3 months. We've been playing golf. He's been kicking my ass, but that's another story for another day.
Well, you beat me a couple times too now.
Well, you were talking shit about me today. Maybe it was the brown liquor talking. By the way, this Belvini.
Yeah.
I'm feeling the buzz, but I'm not feeling the hurt. So if anybody's out there next to an ABC store, it's called Belvini Caribbean Cask Single Malt.
14 years.
Go check it out. Yeah. This is smooth. I'm not a alcohol or liquor connoisseur, but dude, this might be the new one. Scotch might be the new thing. In high school in New York City, I went to Brooklyn Tech, which was a specialized high school. You got to take a test to get in.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same sort of makeup. It was about 40% black, maybe 30-40% white, and then other. When I went through, I did well, and did well academically, but also was an athlete, played soccer, was one of the better soccer players in New York City. And I got a scholarship offer to go to North Carolina State, which I ended up taking. And spring semester of my senior year, everybody's worried about, and when I say everybody, I'm talking about the middle class white kids,
sure,
that are in the school, are worried about paying for college. And that's not a worry of mine anymore. And I don't want to use the word guilty, but maybe in my naivety at 17, it was kind of guilt until I realized, because they were saying, you're so lucky. No, dude. When you were doing whatever the heck you were doing on the weekends, I was playing soccer. I was marketing myself.
Yeah.
To colleges and universities from the time I was 9 years old when I was in a club team.
Yeah.
And every year I knew I had to be better than the next person. So I don't know what you were doing on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
So besides the Monday through Friday stuff at school that I was kind of beating you at anyway,
yeah,
I was doing something more on the weekends to get noticed. So I deserved and I earned this. So my question is, as a young person, were you able to appreciate the fact that you were able to get to law school and Notre Dame, or did you felt some kind of way with, let's be honest, with what the white folks were saying about your deserving it or not?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, to be honest with you, during my undergraduate years, I was a campus activist. I wasn't a campus activist because I felt like I was so thoughtful or somehow, you know, I saw a struggle that I needed to be involved in. I was a campus activist because I needed to do that in order to protect myself and to defend myself. And so, you know, when people come at me with some nonsense about, well, I got a 1350 on my SATs, why is it that you're here and you only have an 1190? My answer to that is, you ran a 100-yard dash. I ran a marathon. You're looking at the finish line. I'm looking at the distance traveled. It's a different race. And so at the end of the day, yeah, you might have had a 13 whatever on your SATs, but you have two college educated parents. You're way above the poverty line. I'm halfway, you know, between the poverty line and you know, being lower middle class. I don't have college educated parents. In fact, neither one of my parents, my birth mother or my adoptive father, graduated high school. By the eighth grade, my parents couldn't help me with my homework. So don't come to me talking to me about, well, I got a higher score on my SATs and therefore I'm more deserving. That's only one measure. It doesn't even make sense to measure one person against another only looking at that one variable. I mean, at the end of the day, when I look at my own children, now my children have two college-educated parents. And so, yeah, I expect more out of them than what I would have expected out of myself, because they're starting from a different place. At that time, I was very deep into the writings and the speeches of Malcolm X.
So, for the folks that are listening, around what time is this?
So this is 1990.
1990.
Yeah.
Think
fall of 1990.
So that's Bush era. That is the internet. No, the internet hasn't taken off.
No, there is no internet.
There's no internet.
There are no cell phones.
No cell phones. We're going back to ancient times here.
We're going back to ancient times.
I'm thinking. So culturally, Living Color? I think Living Color was big.
Yeah.
And you start to see the sort of groundwork for hip hop's explosion. So there is like a pitter-pattering of blackness kind of, I wouldn't say surfacing, it's kind of just like under the water at that point.
Yeah, in the fall of 1990, rap music is still a very urban phenomenon. It's still owned by us.
Right.
You know, there still are no major white acts other than the Beastie Boys.
Beastie Boys. Was Vanilla Ice, or that's...
Vanilla Ice comes later. Maybe a year or two later.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, urban angst is not really at its apex yet. But it's growing. Because really, 1990 is, we're just now really coming out of the real bad years of the crack trade.
Right.
Well, and I'm only speaking from my home city, Philadelphia. I don't know what's going on in Cleveland or Detroit or Chicago.
The 1990, I'm in eighth grade. I don't mean to date you there, brother. But I'm in eighth grade, I'm graduating eighth grade in 1990, and it's crack vials in the schoolyard.
Yeah.
It's crack houses across the street from my middle school.
Yeah.
And I'm now knowing, because I find some old folks on Facebook from middle school. I mean, a young lady was telling me it is mothers selling their daughters into prostitution middle school to get a fix.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're talking desperate times in urban America.
Yeah,
desperate times.
Yeah.
So then counterpose that with Bucknell.
Exactly.
Which is in the middle of suburban Pennsylvania. Far away from that, but you are aware of that reality.
Yeah.
So then, as a campus leader, what's the difficulty? What are the stepping stones in terms of bringing that reality to that campus of, oh, I'm 1300, but that's normal. No, dude, that's not normal. Two college-educated parents, that's normal. No, dude, that's not normal.
That's not normal, yeah. Well, I mean, what it creates in me, I think, is perspective. And so at the end of the day, you know, I got this privileged, you know, motherfucker who's got his own, you know, position in terms of how he sees the world. And he's trying to project onto me, you know, where I fit in the world that he perceives. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, I understand the real world a whole lot better than this cat. And so I don't worry about what this motherfucker thinks.
What's that? Is that the liquor talking? We just read that moment in our first episode of Brown Liquor Chronicles, which is why we're now drinking liquor. And there's something to be said about alcohol getting at it. I don't think this is an advertisement for liquor. I think as black men, we are more in touch with the truth of America and the truth of ourselves, because we have to answer those questions daily, minute by minute, in these encounters that the other folks never consider, like this elevator incident, or the fact that you are 2% of a college population. How do you navigate that? There are questions that folks will never, never come to grips with because you've never had to.
I think it speaks to, you know, my position, you know, in 1990 being challenged that, okay, how is it that you, you know, well, why are you here at Bucknell anyway? And how is it that you and your boy got into Duke Law School and Notre Dame Law School? You know, you asked me, well, how do I deal with those types of challenges? At the end of the day, when you've won, you've got to recognize that you've won. And so I don't have to explain it to this motherfucker. You know what I mean? You know, he don't got the key to Notre Dame Law School. He don't got the key to Duke. It ain't up to him. It reminds me of, you know, when people say, well, you're not going to get into heaven. How do you know? How do you know? You don't got the key. You know, it's not up to these cats. And so really what he's displaying to me is how he feels about his own limitations. You know, the fact that maybe he applied to Notre Dame and didn't get in, or maybe that he applied to Duke and didn't get in. I'm sorry for you, and I'm not going to gloat, but at the end of the day, I'm not going to let you steal my joy, the fact that I did get in, and the fact that, you know, the fact that they let me in doesn't mean that I'm going to finish. So I still got work to do. I don't worry about what other people think or feel or any of that. To me, and this is what I say to young people when I talk to them, you have to figure out how to turn down the noise of life. Because there's a lot of noise all around. There's a lot of noise. But at the end of the day, if you focus on your goal, and I am walking, talking proof. I am just a brother from North Philly. I'm nothing more. Just a brother from North Philly. And I went to Bucknell. I went to Notre Dame Law School. I went to the University of Texas for graduate business school. And I did those things not because I'm smart or because I'm focused. I'm not that smart. I'm really not. I'm not that smart. I'll be the first to admit it. But if you put a program in front of me, I can do it. I can follow directions. You need me to write 4 papers? I'll write 4 papers. You need me to take a test? I'll take a test. You know what I mean? And so you got to break down the goal into achievable tasks. And once you achieve those tasks, next thing you know, you're at the finish line and they're giving you a degree. And following that degree is a salary. Okay. And so, you know, just follow the program. It's really not that hard. But we make life hard by all the noise. You know what I mean? Well, what if in 1990 it was more important for me to have a car than to have a degree? And I wouldn't have finished.
Right.
What if in 1993 it was more important for me to have a house than to have a law degree? I wouldn't have it. You know, you gotta figure out what is your goal, and then you have to have laser focus towards that goal.
Was it something you think that was in you, or was it something that was taught to you?
Yeah, I think it's both, quite frankly. I really do think it's both, because you can have talent without guidance and it's not gonna work. You can have guidance without talent and that's not gonna work. And I think that I was the perfect storm of a person who actually had some talent, but the other part of it is the fact that I had a father who was focused before I was focused. And he, to me, you know, my dad was the perfect example of you have to take on the properties that you want your child to have until your child starts to demonstrate those properties. And I'll give you an example. So my dad, when I was a young guy, a young kid, my dad used to say to me, you know, whatever the lesson was, he would say to me, this lesson is not that difficult. But you're gonna sit at this table until you understand it. And he used to make me sit there, and I would sit there all night until I understood it, because that I didn't have a choice. My dad was like, you ain't getting up until you can explain this to me. Somewhere between the end of high school, somewhere in college, I used to say to myself, you know what, God damn it, I'm not gonna get up from this fucking table until I understand this. My dad's lesson to me, it was so ingrained in me that I started to say it to myself. And I can tell you now, that is the only way I survived law school, because it was the hardest thing I've ever done. I'm not kidding. In fact, I'll give you one quick story. My first year of law school, that's how I found out I was pre-diabetic. They found me in the law library, passed out, because I hadn't eaten in 2 days. because I was so determined not to fail that I was going to sit there until I understood these fucking cases. And they would give you a ridiculous amount of cases to read and then try to synthesize. And it didn't dawn on me that, well, the idea is not to read them all. I don't have a lawyer uncle or a lawyer aunt or some family member or a friend who's a judge who can explain this shit to me. I just gotta power through this shit. And that's what I did. I powered through it. And after 2 days of powering through it, they found me passed out in the goddamn library.
Is that not your name?
Passed out in the library because I'm going into a diabetic coma because I haven't eaten in 2 days. And so, at the end of the day, laser focus. I can tell you that I don't know that my talent probably should have ended me up at Notre Dame, but my grit and determination got me through.
There are specific things that you have figured out. You figured it out in high school, you figured it out at Bucknell, you figured it out after this diabetic shock at Notre Dame, that you could do to maintain the level of academic success that was needed to get you where you wanted to go.
Yeah.
So without getting this was my daily routine, there are specific things that worked for you.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's somebody like you out there listening, what were those things that worked for you? So I mean, that meant that I had to study 5 hours a night. What worked for you? What was focus for you?
Well, that's a good question. And I think the answer to that for me was that conversation with my high school principal, where he said, look, go back to Bucknell and go for it. Show them the person that we know here at Central, the person that we still talk about while you're off at college. I'm explaining examples of how you power through in high school. I combine that with the philosophy that my college coach was also applying at the time, which was interesting that was happening. But He used to say to us, and those of us who played football for Bucknell between 1988 and 1990 will remember this. He used to say to us, we are the working man's football team. When we come to practice, we're bringing our hard hat, we're bringing our lunch pail, and we're gonna work. And I said, yeah, I'm gonna do that athletically, but you know what? I'm gonna do that academically too. And so, I just applied a philosophy of, if I had 3 hours worth of classes, I'm going to do 3 hours worth of study after those classes are over. So I just treated it like a job. And what I found was, wow, this is really effective. And I just powered through college and I got really good grades, and I got the kind of grades that were reflective of my effort. And I thought to myself, okay, so I'm just going to do that for law school. And what I come to realize is that, law school is a little different. The hardest worker doesn't win. Law school is designed to weed out those who either don't want it or who just are not talented enough. Now, I may not have been talented enough, but I wanted it.
Right.
And so it was that desire that got me through. And it was a painful experience, but I have to say, let's keep rising to the top. While I got grades that I'm proud of, I don't know that they were reflective. Like, for example, if I went to law school now, as a more thoughtful, understanding person, I would probably get very different grades, because the thing that I was missing in law school was context. And they don't tell you that, mm-hmm. you know. So, and what I mean by that is this. When you're 22 years old and you just graduated from college, you're not anybody's spouse. You're not anybody's parent. You don't own any land. In fact, you don't own anything other than the clothes on your back. And so you can't put into context cases right. that have fact patterns that have mothers and fathers and landowners and people who are dealing with business situations. And you can't put that into context because you don't have enough life experience. And so, you know, it wasn't necessarily that you didn't have, that I didn't have the intellectual power. I didn't have the context to put the fact patterns into, which I now have as a 48-year-old man. I find it interesting that, you know, at that time at Notre Dame, the average age was 29 years old. What most people do is they graduate from college and they go get some life experience and then they go to graduate school, or, you know, law school or whatever it is that, you know, that they go to. For me, I went straight through because I figured, okay, I had a bad freshman year and now I'm on a roll academically, let me keep it going.
Right.
And you think that law school was just an academic endeavor. It's more than that. It's more than that. But you don't know that until you go.
So was law what you were passionate about from the get-go, or something you're like, this is something I can do, this is something I'm good at, and it, you know, this is going to set me up financially if I'm going to get married and kids and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, well, what's interesting that we're having this conversation, and literally right now, we're showing, we're watching the CNN thing, which talking about the 80s, and they're showing LA Law, right. And I can tell you...
That was it?
That was the show.
Seriously.
And Victor Cifuentes.
Jimmy Smith, who was just on.
He is the lawyer that I wanted to be. I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a courtroom lawyer.
Okay.
And really what I mean to say is I wanted to be an oral advocate. There's something powerful around making an argument that persuades a person that you are right. Intellectually, there's something satisfying about that. When I went to law school, that was my whole... approach and goal. Thought I was going to go with the district attorney's office in Philadelphia, and I got the offer, but the offer was, they were offering a salary that was actually less than the amount of money I got offered as an undergraduate. And so I literally couldn't afford to take the job based on the loans that I had to take in order to get through law school. So I wind up taking a private job and working for a private firm, and it was boring. It was literally boring. It was easy and it was boring, and which was the complete contrast to law school, which was hard and exhilarating. It was lonely too, but that's a whole nother story. So, I mean, I would count myself as an oral advocate now in what I do on a daily basis. I use my law degree quite a bit, but when I decided to make a change, it was clear to me that I needed more skills, and that's the reason why I decided to go to graduate business school, and that was probably the best choice I ever made.
We're talking to Dee again. This is Ubuntu Radio. This is the first episode of the, what are we calling this again?
The Brown Liquor Discussions.
The Brown Liquor Chronicles.
The Brown Liquor Chronicles.
And we just finished the...
The rest of the Balvini.
The rest of the Balvini. So, is there something else?
I got a whole nother Balvini.
Oh, so we're good. We're good on this. And this is a good time to maybe pivot. Like Kellyanne or anybody in the current administration, onto something else. But hopefully you've been listening to this and you understand the story about, you know, coming through Philadelphia, North Philadelphia, born and raised, yeah. all that stuff, on the football field where he spent his days, obviously in the classroom as well, enough to get himself to Bucknell, graduate, and then do what he's doing now. And you mentioned your kids earlier. How old are the kids?
So I have a son who is 17 and on the precipice of college himself, and I have, my baby is 10.
Okay, and you mentioned that your father was, I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I'm sorry, the primary influence?
Yo, no question about it. I was raised by a single father. A single father. So let me be clear. A single adoptive father.
Okay.
How about that?
And that's another, we're gonna talk about that.
Yeah, how many of those are there in the black community?
Right. He's still living?
No, he passed away 8 years ago.
Okay.
8 years ago.
And he was with you from birth till?
He was my father for as long as I can remember. I don't know any other father. I did meet my birth father. I did meet him when I was a grown man. But, I mean, you know, he made me, but he did not raise me.
Right.
He's not my dad. You know, he's my father's son. He's not my dad. My dad, the person who raised me, he passed away 8 years ago.
Would you say that's the single most important relationship in terms of the person that you are now?
Without question. And it's not close.
So the key word today is focus. Finding whatever means you can to get at your dream. I recognize that we've talked about the successes, and we don't want to downplay the fact that there's going to be some tough times. There's going to be times where that are going to ask you to do and be more, and you've got to rise above and do those. So talk about a little bit about the failures. About
yeah. Well, I,
when you questioned yourself.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I can tell you that, you know, my first day of law school, in my very first class, my professor is speaking English, but I can't understand a goddamn word he's saying because he's using these legal terms I had never heard.
Right.
And I'm in class with, you know, 85 other motherfuckers. I'm looking back and everybody else seemed to be okay with what this dude is saying. I don't understand shit. And I ain't gonna lie to you, I went back to my dorm room and I cried like a fucking baby because I was like, I'm in deep shit. 22 years old. I'm 22 years old. I'm 6'2". I'm 210 pounds of cut muscle. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm just finished my college football career. You know, I'm big, you know what I mean? And I'm crying because I'm like, how am I gonna get through this? I don't understand what this motherfucker is even saying. And he's speaking English. And so I said, okay, all right, stop acting like a bitch, get yourself together. And so what I did was, I kept a journal. And I had to be honest with myself, you got some remedial work to do. You know, your vocabulary is not as strong as it needs to be. You know, they're saying some shit that you don't understand. So you have to up your vernacular. And so what I did was, every time I heard a word that I didn't understand, I would write it down. I would go back to my dorm room, I'd look it up, and I would write out the what the meaning of the word was. And then I would make it a point to try to work that word into my vernacular.
Where did that idea come from? Because I think there are people who go to high school or middle school and hear that, but they don't do what you just did. So where did that come from? Is that natural? Did somebody teach you how to do that? Because I think that's the part that I think people don't address. That situation existed for, I think, more people than you probably recognize in that first year or that first semester of Notre Dame Law. But you decided to do that. And some people may not have, and not just in law school, but in high school. So what is it about you that made you do that? Was it the athlete in you? Was it dad? What was it?
I think really what that is me saying to myself, I am not going to fail. And if I do fail, it's going to be because I just don't have the ability to. It's not going to be because I didn't try.
Gotcha.
I took a course while I was at Bucknell. I took a number of courses, Black History courses, to just, you know, understand our journey a little bit better. And to me, I think this is the power of perspective. It's easier to stay focused if you understand what's been paid for you to be where you are. And what I mean by that is, when I would get discouraged and it would seem hard, I had this book of writings by slaves, and they wrote what freedom meant and what they thought freedom could be for them. And it helped to build perspective for me, because at the end of the day, the challenge of law school is what? No one's chasing me. No one's looking to hurt me. All I have to do is do my best. Just try. That's all I have to do. Just try. And if it doesn't work out, then okay. But at least if you look back and say, I did the best I could, and this is where I am, then okay. Then everything that went before you, all those people who were lynched, all of those people who were beaten, all of those people who were free but decided to stand on the bridge and to take the dogs and to take the hoses. For me, I feel a deep obligation that I owe them my best. Mm-hmm. I owe them the opportunity. I owe them whatever it is that I can do in that instance, meaning take that test, write that paper, make that argument, whatever it is, I owe them my best effort. And it energized me. And whenever I thought it was hard, I mean, when I look at young people today, it's like, you don't even know or understand what was paid for you to have the freedom to walk down the street with your pants. Do you know that 50 years ago, you would be hanging from a light post for that? And there were people who took dogs, who took hot coffee at the counter, you know, who took people spitting on them, you know, calling them names, hitting them, beating them, you know what I mean? And we don't have to deal with any of that now. There's a reason for that, because the price was already paid. Right. And so what price are you going to pay in order to make sure that those doors that were kicked open 50, 60 years ago stay open?
What a lovely, precious dream.
That's how I stay focused. I mean, at the end of the day, my challenge is infinitesimally small compared to the challenge that we're faced, that you know, the generation before me faced. All I gotta do is study. All I gotta do is write the paper. All I gotta do is come up with the argument. Nobody's chasing me, nobody's gonna hurt me. In this whole wide world, how hard is that?
We're going to take a little break and fill up this Belvini single malt 14 years aged scotch. And then we're going to come back and discuss more, because I think we're at a perfect point to move on to, it's like Inception. There's another level of blackness. Black intelligence. We talk about the corporate shit. We talk about how we got here. And we're going to talk about Some real shit. We're talking about some real shit
mm-hmm.
for the next couple of minutes, but we're going to take a little break and come back to Ubuntu Radio. Come on back.